And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Welcome to the Dave Cave Batman Podcast, a Two True Freaks presentation. I am your host, J. David Weider, but here in my sanctum, deep beneath stately Dave Manor, you can call me Dave. And this is the show where I tackle my lengthy post-crisis Batman reading project one issue at a time, loosely based on the chronology of the Dark Knight's career from year one to No Man's Land. And this time we add a new member to Batman's rogues gallery, the femme fatale Poison Ivy, and we will see her retroactive debut here in Batman Shadow of the Bat Annual No. 3. And this is the 1995 annual that was actually released in August of that year. We have a cover by Brian Stelfreeze showing Poison Ivy lounging next to a bush as Batman is seen held by a tree in the background, seemingly unconscious. And the only word I can describe this cover with is awkward. I mean, Poison Ivy's pose is supposed to be relaxed, but she's grimacing at us, and the pose is simply just posed. There's nothing natural or organic about this cover. Nobody's participating in the scene. Batman looks cool in the crucifixion pose in the background, but again, awkward is the only word I can come up with. And the story inside is entitled Poison Ivy Year 1 or Year 1 Poison Ivy, depending on which source you're looking at. And it was written by Alan Grant, penciled by Brian Apthorpe, inked by Stan Walk, and lettered by Ken Lopez, with colors by Linda Medley. No relation to the Medley brothers or the Righteous brothers that I am aware of. And we open in Gotham City because it would be weird to open in Metropolis or Central City. Batman is interrogating a low-level thug by dangling him off the side of a building. Batman gets the info he's looking for, because of course he does, and is swinging across Gotham when a burglar alarm catches his attention. When Batman reaches the source of the alarm, a department store, a man comes stumbling out and spores form all over the man, and he bursts open. The man literally bursts open from the mushrooms inside of his chest cavity. Batman realizes two things. One, the man is dead. And two, the victim was a distraction because there are thieves getting away via a high-level catwalk above. And leading the group of thieves is the green-clad, red-haired Poison Ivy, who shakes Batman by kissing a patron at a rooftop restaurant, compelling him to leap off a building. And that gives Batman a choice, catch the thief or rescue the victim, and of course, Batman rescues the victim, at the loss of Poison Ivy and her gang, who are now long gone. Later, beneath Wayne Manor, Batman rides a motorcycle into his cave, which he is using as a base, lamenting that he does not have a car for his nightly patrols. As Bruce takes a shower, which becomes a chilling experience thanks to Alfred, Ivy and her men are back at their hideout, and Ivy thinks of her past, specifically pondering how men have always deceived her. Her father spoiled her, but was so distant that she never knew him. Jason Woodrue experimented on her and changed her from a teenage girl into something else. But, she thinks, maybe Batman will be different. She doesn't get a chance to dwell on it long because her lackeys decide to remove her from the equation. The men learn their lesson when Ivy's plants gruesomely overpower them, allowing Ivy to make the killing blow with a gun. Back at the cave, Bruce analyzes the lipstick used at the restaurant. He learns that it is a low-level poison, making the victim susceptible to suggestion and hallucination. The spores, however, are even more mysterious. The mushrooms have been genetically altered to their current form, but Bruce does not have the equipment needed to study them fully. Our scene shifts and Bruce is attending a charity dinner for a city councilman with actress B.B. Danielle on his arm, and Bruce sees Jim Gordon providing security for the event. The councilman has a date of his own, Pamela Isley, a plant biologist who works part-time for an escort agency. She might be important, people. Later in the party, champagne is served to every guest, but Bruce substitutes his for mineral water. That turns out to be a good thing, as all of those who drank the bubbly begin to sprout mushrooms all over their skin. Pamela Isley is noticeably unaffected, and she manages to incapacitate Gordon with a kiss, revealing herself to be Poison Ivy, and the party is now a hostage situation. Bruce tries to escape by making it appear that he clumsily overtakes a couple of guards, but that doesn't last long because he is knocked out with the butt of a gun, and Ivy reveals her plot. She has a single bottle of an antidote to the mushroom growth that the people are seeing, the low-level poison they're reacting to, and she will hand it over in exchange for the valuable items of the crowd. So of course, Gotham's richest citizens are handing over jewelry, cash, and more as fast as they know how when Bruce comes to again, just in time to see his date shot when she protests. Bruce once again tries to fight but is beaten and given a kiss by Ivy that is loaded with a poison that will kill him within an hour without the mystery antidote. The crowd gets their antidote to their poison, but they are warned. If Ivy does not get $10 million by the weekend, the full poison will be released into Gotham's air. After Ivy leaves, Bruce suits up as Batman and uses a tracer he slipped on her to pursue the villainess. He's already feeling the effects of the poison, but Batman goes to face Ivy at the plant factory anyway. A weakened Batman barely gets through the guards and finds himself quickly overpowered by Poison Ivy herself and held captive by her plants. Ivy kisses Batman, wanting to say she did so before he died, and she also reveals the antidote to the poison in Batman's system is a second kiss from Ivy's lips. Unknowingly, Ivy has delivered the cure to Batman. As a fire begins to rage in the plant because of Batman's phosphorus grenade, Batman gets his second wind and uses his cape to trap Ivy, finally bringing her to justice. And the issue ends with Ivy in Arkham Asylum vowing that Batman cannot reject her because when Poison Ivy gets you, that itch lasts forever. And scene. Okay, jumping into this, I'm going to be straight up with you. I had very middle-of-the-road expectations of the issue, given that it was part of the Year One series of annuals from 1995, and Catwoman didn't really set the bar very high, but this issue was actually really good. I ended up with a lot of insight, and I should have known better because it's Alan Grant. One of Grant's strengths is the psychology of characters, and he's actually very good at maintaining a theme throughout an entire issue. But the real surprise for me was Brian Apthorpe. I mean, we open the issue with this awesome splash page, and it's Batman dangling a guy off a side of a building, which we've seen thousands of times. But this is great looking. I know Apthorpe did some light work for DC and then retired from the comic industry to go into other ventures, but looking at this, the spotlights in the background, the Art Deco building, which is incredibly detailed, it just hit the spot for me. Sort of an overall observation of Apthorpe's art is that he reminds me a lot of Tom Mandrake, but Apthorpe has better layouts, more dynamic layouts. The exception to the Mandrake comparison is his Batman. Apthorpe's Batman looks like the love child of Darwin Cook and Matt Wagner. Sort of that throwback style with the curved ears and things of that nature, it looks phenomenal. It does feel very much like an early version of Batman, the proto-costume you would see from the Golden Age. So I was actually very impressed because I had very low expectations of an artist I had admittedly never heard of, but now I'm kind of a fan. Now the scene with Batman dangling the guy off the roof, you have to ask yourself, as many times as we've seen it, how many times in a crime-fighting career would that actually occur? What, maybe 35 or 40 times maximum? But yet we've seen it countless times at this point. And used here, it's sort of just an introductory device. It has no real bearing on the story because the story really kicks in when the guy dies with the spores. Grant has no qualms about delivering body horror right out of the gate, and it works. It definitely stands to get our attention. It's a solid harbinger of Poison Ivy as well. Really, Grant is putting his thesis sentence on this guy's death. And that thesis is very basic. Ivy is not to be trifled with. She's not a B-level villain. She's deadly, and she's definitely not Catwoman. Catwoman is many things. She is a thief, she is a temptress, whatever you want to put on there, but she's not a killer. Ivy, however, has no such qualms. Catwoman leaves scratches, but those scratches don't sprout mushrooms to pop your chest open. So right out of the gate, Grant is saying, yes, they're both females, they're both Batman villains, but that's really where the comparisons end. And Ivy actually admires Batman. She describes him as perhaps the perfect man. Given that a lot of her psychosis and a lot of her motivation comes from being deceived by men, it's a curious idea that she's fixating on a man with a mask. And give a little bit of credence to that because wearing a mask is at least an open deception. You know that person's hiding something from you. Where most of Ivy's deception or her manipulation was a distant father where Jason Woodrue would come in and try to fill that void and use that to manipulate her. I'm going to talk about that just a little bit down the road. So first we see death by Ivy's mushrooms, then we see a man jumping off the roof at her command. The jumper scene is genuinely exciting. Apthorpe really, really excels at progressive motion, and his action seems to be kinetic. It seems to be in motion, and it does so seamlessly. As Batman rescues the jumper, he has these inner thoughts. To fail once is to fail forever. Because failure for Batman is death. Death is permanent. So for Batman, every night he goes out, the stakes are at top level. Do or die. Literally, do or die. There's no real middle ground, and Bruce is really wearing that idea on his shoulders, that he is responsible for the lives of the people he comes in contact with when he's Batman, and when he's not, which comes into play later in the story. And so he leaps after the victim, of course he does. The choice was never really a choice. Now to kind of progress forward, I know many people may be wondering why I slotted this particular issue in this particular spot. Well, first off, I want to clarify something, as I've been thinking about it as my return to the Dave Cave is becoming more cemented. I've decided that it's more accurate to call this show themed off of chronology than actually trying to hold to a loose chronology. In other words, I'm doing my best to try to put these stories in the natural order they would occur as far as the Batman's development, but that's not always going to be the case, and sometimes we will move forward just to jump back again, as we've seen with Year One several times. But more germane to this particular issue is we have Batman showing up in the cave on a motorcycle, lamenting that he doesn't have a Batmobile. Now, the Batmobile is going to become key to the next sequence of episodes and as we go forward. So the lack of Batmobile is one piece. The second is that this story seems to be keying off of Shaman directly, where Shaman, we found the cave. And here we have the beginnings of what will be the Batcave. We have some cement being laid, we have shovels, the work is progressing, but for the most part it's just a big cavern. No giant Penny, no big T-Rex, no giant computer banks yet, but they're coming, and that's the hint that Grant is laying down here. And I don't know 100% if Grant was intentionally keying off the time frame from Shaman, but if he wasn't, it's still a good coincidence, and if he was, that's extremely good continuity. And it would make sense since Denny O'Neil is still the editor and Denny O'Neil wrote that five-part series. And Grant is sort of structuring his reveals really well here because we have Bruce seeing Ivy from the outside, kind of what we've experienced so far. He describes Ivy as walking within a mist of pheromones. Of course, he describes Ivy as extremely attractive, and then he looks at the lipstick, sort of we're following the evidence trail here. He discovers that the lipstick is a hallucinogen, and actually relates it back to real-world history that witches in the medieval times would use it as a lotion, causing the visions of people to see them, quote-unquote, flying. And again, we're looking at the accelerated plant growth, which gives us quite a few pieces of Ivy's external view. And of course, Alfred gives Bruce a cold shower, because why not? The exterior view of Ivy happens in two scenes, Bruce's return to the cave as he goes into the shower, and then after a scene where he is getting ready for the party. Sandwiched between these external views is seeing Ivy from within, her own internal monologue, and we see her father, who was a stranger who gave her all kinds of material things, but no affection, not even a person to her. I mean, when we see him, it is as a silhouette against a window. We have no features, no specific idea of what he looked like. That's not an accident. That's how Ivy sees her father in her own internal thoughts. But it also kind of explains why Ivy is into stealing, because she likes the material things. Those were affection to her as a kid. And the fact that that is there, I mean, it is very heavy-handed, but at the same time, Grant knows how to meter that by giving us a single panel and a single statement and not dwelling on it. And then we move to Jason Woodrue, who manipulated and poisoned, literally poisoned Ivy. Now, his experiments made her immune to toxins, but it drove her insane. And the thing about Woodrue is that he plays on the father figure thing as well, because he comes in, he's an authority figure as a professor, and he uses that surrogate father status to allow him to put her into a dangerous and destructive situation to emotionally and physically torture her. He 100% gaslights her and puts her into this position through sickening methods, and most likely knowingly doing so. And for those that don't know Jason Woodrue, he is the Floronic Man. He's a living plant from another dimension, which luckily Grant doesn't really acknowledge. And the thing about the psychology setup in this very, very minimal scene is that it's solid. It tracks. We know exactly why Ivy is motivated to do the things she's done. She's been hurt. She's been deceived. She's had genuinely deserved affection withheld, and borderline weaponized to some extent. So we get that psychology of Ivy, and then we get the other side. We go external again, because her lackeys decide they're going to cut her out of the equation and take her share, and then they get brutally killed. One guy gets barbs from a cactus through his hand, literally through his hand. The other guy gets this blistering agent of a rue plant in his eyes, and it's burning. And there's a subtle hint here, never actually outright said, that Ivy is controlling these plants, but at the same time, maybe the plants are just reactive. Either way, Ivy has no issues with pointing the gun at the guys who are incapacitated and blowing their heads off. That is what she has become. That is the result of the manipulation that Grant has set up. This is solid storytelling and really banks on the minimalization of the exposition. It's a very good story strategy because we get everything we need. We don't dwell on it. We don't get it spoon-fed, but it's all right there. Not buried deep, but not necessarily put in your face and saying, "Look at me." Now, of course, these scenes are leading to the main event, really, which is the party. And Bruce is actually planning on ducking out to go searching for Ivy, which is one of the main reasons he skips drinking the champagne. And that has, not quite irony, but poetic justice to it, that by skipping that, he's well aware and alert when she actually shows up. So that kind of ruins his plans to go looking for her later because she's already there. I love Ivy's hostage situation in this. I thought it was brilliant. It made perfect sense. She picks a high-profile event, and then she springs the trap, and she's blackmailing everyone into willingly giving up their valuables. Yes, there are guns present. The only thing the guns are used for is to knock Bruce out. Everybody else is like, yeah, take it. Just give me that antidote. Here's what I want to call out on the hostage scene, because it comes down to Bruce here. We see Bruce beaten twice. The first time he's beaten is because he's hiding. He's deceiving. He's showing the Bruce Wayne face, pretending to be clumsy as he's actually taking out guards, and his deception limits him. because he can't just use his full force because he has to keep that secret identity, which is how Ivy is able to knock him the F out. Now, the second time, it's because he's moving on raw emotion. His date is shot, which she only gets a flesh wound, she's fine, but she's shot and he sheds all of his discipline and goes completely by emotion. And that reckless emotion costs him. And reckless emotion is definitely Ivy's forte, so she actually gets under his skin. The thing about this entire hostage situation, this whole party scene, is that it's a power dynamic. It's a struggle between Bruce and Ivy. And in some cases, it mirrors the way Ivy had a struggle with Woodrue. Because Woodrue asserted power over Pamela Isley, Ivy's putting Bruce into submission in the same way. And the reason I say it's the same way is that her poison is delivered with a kiss. And not for nothing, the kiss shot is awesome. It's a hallucination, and that further cements the allegory to me, because we have Woodrue showing the promise or the illusion of affection, but at the same time, it's actually being emotionless and callous, and downright cruel. So Poison Ivy actually becomes a thing that created her in many, many ways. And once everything's said and done, really without being said, Grant is coming back to the thesis he had with Batman early in the issue, fail once, fail forever. This event could have been the big failure. To call it out, Bruce was completely and totally ineffective here. People could have died, and that would have been on Bruce's shoulders, which will probably show Bruce leaning a little bit more into his Batman identity, because Batman can accomplish more than Bruce Wayne can, but it's also something that's going to drive him now, throughout the rest of this particular issue. This situation was completely and totally out of Bruce's control. We're dealing with dominance issues, and Bruce was dominated. Make no mistake about it. And that actually creates a really good action sequence for the third act of this issue, where we have a sick Batman, a dying Batman, rushing to get the cure and also stop Ivy from killing everybody by the weekend. So those stakes that were set up at the top of the issue, where fail once, fail forever, or Batman's always a do or die type of thing, they completely come to fruition in the third act. Now first off, Batman barely makes it through the gang. It's good action, but he's definitely struggling with these thugs. And it occurred to me, where did Ivy get her gang? I mean, she shot her lackeys. Grant provides for that in his story because they are longing for a kiss from her lips or what have you. She basically seduced him with those pheromones. Her power means that there's a never-ending line of male thugs to work for her. Before Batman comes bursting in, Pamela is really considering Dr. Woodrue's description of her. She's a mass of contradictions. A deadly mass of contradictions at that. And we find Ivy doing so. She hopes that the people won't pay because that way she can release the poison. So A, she's not bluffing. B, she's tempted to do it just to watch people die, to be vengeful. But a moment later, she chastises herself because she's a good girl. She doesn't do that. So she's somebody who is struggling with her new identity, her new version of herself, whatever that is, as Poison Ivy. She's a victim-turned-victimizer, so she knows what it feels like to be on the receiving end, but at the same time, she has no desire to go back to being the recipient of that kind of abuse or deception. There's almost a proactive stance of stopping things before they even start. So she's a reaction to that situation, but she's not quite as equal and opposite as you would expect. Batman comes running in, and the first thing he does is throw a phosphor grenade to burn the poison. So he has already figured out he has to have a backup plan, because there's a good chance, a very real chance, he may not survive this showdown. Again, Alan Grant showing us fail once, fail forever, and Batman is focusing on the danger and then Ivy, so he's learned to remove certain distractions from his game plan. He's prioritizing the real danger and making sure that, should he fall, Gotham is safe, at least from this particular scheme. And Grant comes closest to being heavy-handed as Ivy is talking about plants and how they respond if you call them. They scream if you prick them. You have to listen closely enough. To me, that's a subtle hint that Ivy has a connection with plants that allows her to do things to manipulate them. But it's also kind of symbolic of a cry for help, one that goes ignored or goes unheard, much like Pamela Isley's call for help. Her internal or subtle cries for help would go unheard. You just have to listen closely enough. And I want to make clear that he does not become heavy-handed. It's the closest he gets to being more blunt about, hey, pay attention to the people around you. But I didn't feel like it stopped the issue dead in its tracks to deliver a message, which is a great skill. Batman's in the worst situation he can be in. He is dying. He is at her mercy, captured by plants, and of all things, Ivy's kiss is the thing that has doomed Bruce. It turns around and redeems him. To me, that becomes the crux of this entire issue, the crux of the character of Poison Ivy here. From beginning to end, Ivy is in control of every situation, even when she doesn't realize it. By giving Batman a kiss, she ends up healing him because she kissed him as Bruce Wayne. It is her actions that define Batman's living or dying here. The irony that it was deception that undid this does not go unnoticed by me. Because Batman's wearing a mask, because she doesn't realize Bruce Wayne and Batman are the same person, she decides to doom Batman with a kiss, unknowingly undoing the kiss she did to Bruce Wayne. Thankfully, she doesn't seem to connect the two. but that idea at the beginning of the issue where Batman would be the ideal man, yes, he wears a mask so his deception is open, doesn't really go as deeply into Ivy as she thinks. She had a chance here to unmask Batman. That was within her power, very easily done. It's not like he can struggle against it or stop her at this point. So to some extent, Ivy chooses to embrace the deception, embrace the illusion of Batman, not realizing that that's what's going to stop her. So retroactively, maybe that means she chose to embrace the deception of Jason Woodrue, knowing what he's doing is wrong, but because of her lack of father, because of that lack of relationship, she wants the bare minimum affection that he offers. That is straight up the abuser's cycle. You wonder why women don't leave abusive men or vice versa? It's because there's other sides to that story. Those people can charm them. Those people can really manipulate them by showing a side to them that may to some extent be real. The affectionate, sort of loving side. And, you know, I believe that there are levels of people. It's not complete black and white. It's shades of gray. But at the same time, you wonder why they don't leave them. Because 60% of the time, 80% of the time, they're that affectionate, loving person. But there's that percentage of the time that they're abusive, straight up abusive, mentally, physically, and those are more devastating. Those stand out, but they're fewer and far between. So the person always wants to believe that the person will change, that the abuser will stop being the abuser and just be full-time that other person. It's not always as easy and clear-cut as it may seem from the outside looking in. Please always remember that, and that's what we're seeing here with Ivy, that it's a complex situation. But in this case, it's a situation that Ivy controls, that she had choices and that she didn't really take advantage of those choices. Now, let's be clear, Ivy's a bad guy, so she needed to be defeated. The end here is that Ivy is taken out of the equation for a while. Her scheme is stopped. But that doesn't mean there's not a piece of Pamela Isley in here, that she was abused, she was manipulated, and that's what created Poison Ivy. And Grant really does layer this on where it's all clearly in front of us, but it's not necessarily spoon-fed. He doesn't stop to narrate. He doesn't wink at the camera and say, see, look what I did there. The entire issue is sort of a struggle for dominance, and that's within themes of gender politics. Ivy was manipulated into being submissive, so she changed, decided to become dominant in a big way, and she did. She remained dominant throughout this story. Every beat is under her control. The only time she lost control was when Batman rejects her, which may be the weakest part of the story, because that flip-flopped the entire thing where Batman becomes the ungettable get. He becomes the object of her affection. So in that case, it stops being about Ivy and starts being about Batman. So we don't quite get a woman in a fridge, but we get another male-dominated story. We get Ivy defeating herself on the basis of Batman's affections. And that's bothersome a little, but we have to establish that she's going to be an ongoing villain. This is a retroactive tale. Had this been the actual chronological debut of the post-crisis Poison Ivy, the question I ask myself is, would I want her to come back again? And the answer is absolutely yes. One of the best things a villain can do is not just challenge a hero, but force him or her to grow, to find new tactics. That was one of the great things about the early Ditko and Lee Spider-Man, is that every villain delivered a defeat that built a better Spider-Man. And with this particular annual, Grant seems to be taking a page out of that, showing Batman and Bruce potential weaknesses and allowing him to grow and become better. Now, it doesn't come completely at the expense of Ivy. That is a component, but it's not a complete expense of Ivy, because she is still established and she is not to be trifled with. Alan Grant manages to make Poison Ivy a credible threat, and at the same time a sympathetic character, which is not as easy as you might think. Ivy's not as prismatic as Catwoman. There's not as many directions she can go, because once you see her cap a couple of her lackeys, you're done. You know she's a killer. But she's definitely a dynamic contradiction that's something I would want to see more of and explore. But yeah, had this been the actual debut of the post-crisis Poison Ivy, this would have been a stellar debut, and I would have been looking forward to her return, bigger, badder, and ready to go. And I think under a lesser writer, this story could have been very hackneyed, very heavy-handed. But as it is, Alan Grant is deft at weaving in psychological elements and story ideas. So read just a little bit closely, this issue leaves us with a lot to think about in terms of real-world stuff, but also leaves the Batman universe and the Rogues Gallery richer by one Poison Ivy. But that's going to wrap me up this time. Next time, we begin the five-part saga Prey from the pages of Legends of the Dark Knight. And we'll see Batman face his own manipulator, who will turn the Dark Knight's strengths into his potential doom. Until next time, cave dwellers, be good. The Dave Cave Batman Podcast is a J. David Weider production and is made for entertainment purposes only. Batman, Batgirl, Robin, and all related characters are copyright and trademarked DC Comics and DC Entertainment. No revenue is generated by the discussion of these topics. All music and sound clips are used for entertainment and illustrative purposes only, and no copyright infringement is intended. Thank you for listening to the Dave Cave Batman Podcast. I'm J. David Weider. I will talk to you next time.